welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse at naturalnurse.com, and we're so happy to bring you the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network, Gary Knowles Network, and you can always listen in at prn.fm. One of the great things is we love you to join us every Tuesday at 10 a.m. when we do the show live. But also, if that's not a good time for you, you can listen to this show and all the shows on Progressive Radio Network by going to the archives at prn.fm archives. Also, Dr. Zamperone and myself would like to invite you to join us on the ground, in person. And we do many workshops and lectures all around the country. Last week we were in Florida. Next week we will be in Texas, and lots of workshops in the New York area as well. We took a group to Chinatown last week where we actually did Qigong in the park, had a sacred sit-down Chinese tea ceremony, and it was so filled that we had to split the group into two. We also took doctors from Stony Brook University for 3 college credits to the West Indies, to Jamaica, in an area where we studied with shamanic healers for a week and actually only ate what was available that we could collect. So that was a phenomenal experience, and it was actually our 26th year of providing that excursion into the jungle. And up and coming, we have many herb walks in the New York area where we go out and collect edible and medicinal plants and teach you how to make your own medicine. So we're very happy today to bring aboard our guest, and that is Christopher Ochner. Dr. Ochner is a leading researcher on nutrition and the brain at Mount Sinai School of Medicine and the New York Obesity Nutrition Research Center. Along with his co-author, Harvard-trained neurologist Dr. Richard Isaacson, who is an associate professor of clinical neurology specializing in Alzheimer's disease at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, Dr. Ochner co-wrote the book, The Alzheimer's Diet, which we will be focusing on today, a step-by-step nutritional approach for memory loss prevention and treatment. And a great place to find out more is at theadplan.com. That's theadplan.com. Or at alzheimersdiet.com. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks for being our guest right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Thanks for having me.
Now, can you tell me the correct pronunciation of your last name?
You got it exactly right. It's Ochner.
Okay, and Ochner, and may we call you Dr. Chris during our interview today?
You may call me whatever you like.
Uh-oh, that's more of an opening than you may want to introduce. But we'll go with Dr. Chris. That sounds great and
sure.
Easy for our listeners to hear about. Now, you have presented some excellent research, and I guess you brought together looking at all the research that is actually available on how targeted nutrients and aggressive dietary change could improve memory.
That's exactly right, and you kind of hit the nail on the head there with our real goal was to take the actual research, what's the empirical scientific data out there, rather than, you know, there's so much stuff out there that's like somebody's opinion, and I don't know, there's conspiracy theory, and there's too much of this and that, and that's causing everything bad, and no, we went, what does the data say? Okay, let's take that, because we're, you know, we're research guys, we're the nerds, right? So we took that and said, okay, how do we then make this interesting and make this digestible to everybody, right? And that's really what the book is. So it's taking what's the best evidence, right? What's the best evidence for these nutritional approaches for Alzheimer's? And there's a lot. It's amazing. I mean, within the last 5 years, there's been an explosion. So we took it and basically put it together. It's like a greatest hits.
Well, what I find is as I review any of the research, and I've been involved in natural medicine since 1964, and there is a recurrent theme in the literature because it always seems to relate back to inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at a diet and lifestyle that brings down the factors that increase inflammation, it seems to have a positive effect on basically every degenerative illness. So I would not be surprised if it also can be focused for Alzheimer's.
Absolutely, 100%. So there's a couple of big mechanisms of action. And you know as well as anybody, with Alzheimer's disease, we don't understand it 100%. We don't even understand 100% what causes it, right?
Well, let me bring up something that I heard once that was interesting, and like what you're saying, the not knowing part. I remember reading about a nun who actually lived very old, and for some reason they did do an autopsy on her when she passed away, and they found that her brain was completely riddled with the plaque and other indicators that she should have had advanced Alzheimer's, and
mm-hmm.
yet she did not even have one symptom of it.
Very similar to a lot of studies they've done in animals, where they've basically given them the plaques, a lot of plaques, right? And so what we're finding is that that's probably necessary but not sufficient. Okay, so you will see that, and that is a hallmark, if not the hallmark, of Alzheimer's. But what also seems to be an essential component are these neurofibril tangles. Okay, so basically you get neurons sort of gummed up and tangled up, and you can't get proper neuronal functioning, and you're going to get some degeneration. So it's actually going to damage physically the structure of the brain. And so once you put that together, it depends. Some people might see effects. Some people might not see anything. But when you put all those things together, then you're really, and as far as we know, you're talking Alzheimer's.
Now, I want to really applaud your book, The Alzheimer's Diet, A Step-by-Step Nutritional Approach for Memory Loss, Prevention, and Treatment. I have it in my hand right here, and I'll tell you some things I really appreciated about this book. Even though yourself and your co-author, Dr. Isaacson, are obviously highly trained and respected in what I like to call conventional medical circles, because when I use the word traditional, I'm referring to herbal medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So you are obviously well educated and have all the right credentials, yet you wrote this book obviously so that people, just regular people who don't have your kind of education, can understand something that's very important in their life. And you also have large type in this book,
right,
which is great because that makes it a focus-friendly book for the exact group of people who really need this information.
I'm glad, Joe. That's exactly our intent. Again, nail on the head. So we, wanted to give it. We couldn't, without making it too long, we couldn't go any larger with the print, but we did go with a larger size font, definitely just to make it a little bit easier. And, we wanted to bridge that gap, like we were talking about a little bit before, between the science and then getting it to everybody, the people that really need it, right? We have all this great information in these medical journals, and nobody can understand it. It's all, the scientific lingo, and it's difficult to understand, and you need 9 PhDs even to get through the introduction, right? We didn't want that. We wanted something that anybody could pick up and read, no matter where you are. Even if you're a physician, they should still get something out of it, but anybody should be able to understand it.
Oh, absolutely. The information is well documented, but it's presented in a way that people can access it.
I'm glad to know we accomplished that goal. Thank you.
So, what did you find when you started looking into the link between Alzheimer's and eating?
A lot more than we had originally anticipated. So I'll tell you, my co-author and I, we've been friends and colleagues for a long time, and he was really, for the past 10 years or so, he's really the hardcore Alzheimer's expert, and I was really the hardcore nutrition expert. And we both, they both sort of started to bleed together. Maybe 5 years ago, we saw the first inclination, and in the past several years, we both started saying, hey, you know, there's all this new and really interesting, and it looks really promising, all this new research about nutrition for Alzheimer's. So, you know, it was right in both of our wheelhouses. And so we started to dig a little bit, and we really didn't have to dig that far. It was amazing. I mean, some of these studies show effect sizes that are as large or larger than current FDA-approved medications, right? So you can make small changes in your diet can have a profound effect on the course of Alzheimer's.
And isn't that amazing that people just think, well, it's just inevitable? And you're saying it's not inevitable, that choices you make now can change outcomes as you age.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And we really stress prevention. Right. So for, you know, a lot of people, as much as, yes, some people say, well, it's inevitable, there's the whole other side that says, Alzheimer's, that's one of those that'll never happen to me things. You know, and you know, the unfortunate fact is that in the latter stages of life, right, in the latter stages of life, 85 and beyond, it's not just a possibility, but it is in fact a probability that we will develop symptoms of Alzheimer's, okay? And we know that Alzheimer's begins in the brain 20 to 30 years before we ever see symptoms, okay? So the message there is don't wait. If you're 40 years old, 50 years old, thinking, man, I don't have to worry about that. We don't want to alarm anybody, but you can make simple changes today that will help prevent, and that's really the good news, okay? Simple changes in diet can have a profound effect, especially for prevention. I'll give you a great example. They just did a study a little while ago on berries, okay? Something as simple as berries. We say a cup a day will keep the Alzheimer's away. Almost literally, okay, they showed that adults that ate a half a cup of berries just a couple of times a week delayed the onset of Alzheimer's for an average of 2.5 years. Okay, and those are good, that's a quality life. Those are good years from just some berries, and berries are delicious. This isn't like the days of cod liver oil and stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Not that there's anything wrong with cod liver oil.
Exactly, exactly. It's good for you. But, you know, these are easy, healthy, delicious choices, things that you can do. And so that was really our goal. Let's put all of these together. And if you think about it, just from one little thing, if you can get 2.5 more good years of life, think about if you put a whole bunch of things like that together.
Well, that's what you have right on the cover of your book, A Beautiful Strawberry. Let me ask you, did you consider at all how the, let's say, strawberries, which of course are very highly sprayed with very toxic pesticides, so was there any indication whether there's a difference if berries are organic or the variety that's less sprayed? Like, for instance, blueberries are actually overall less sprayed than strawberries. Was that taken into consideration at all, or just consuming berries indicated a difference?
Yeah, that was not. It's a really good question. And we yet don't know exactly, you know, how much, which ones are sprayed more, how much of an effect that's going to have on Alzheimer's versus other, you know, health consequences. So as far as I know, there was no accounting for that. It certainly was not mentioned in the article. So it's one of those things that, you know, we recommend being wary of that. And certainly the more you can afford to, a lot of times it becomes a price issue or a cost issue for a lot of individuals. But the more you can afford to eat the whole foods, the natural foods, without the steroids, without the pesticides, without the additives, without the preservatives, right? We definitely recommend that. But if you can't, we understand that can be prohibitive for some people. You know, it's still very important to get the macronutrient balance, even if you're going to get some of these other things that we would rather avoid. The macronutrient balance is probably, we would say, the most important thing. And then beyond that, then look into, you know, getting farm-raised things and things like that.
Okay, that's a good description. So eat berries. If you can, eat organic berries. If
yep.
you can't afford organic berries, eat regular berries. But what we do, what we often recommend is, you know, there are times of year, particularly when whatever berry it is in season,
mm-hmm.
that even the organic ones are very cost effective. I mean, the difference in price might be 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And I often tell patients, when they're available, stock up your freezer. Because did you look into if using frozen berries is also fine versus fresh?
No idea. Now, theoretically, right, looking into the chemistry, if they are flash frozen, it should not make a difference. It's just a matter of whether they're adding any chemicals to it through that process. So that study has not been done. But again, you know, we agree 100%, and it's funny, we use the same recommendation for stocking up. When you find things and there's a sale on something, absolutely, absolutely stock up. And we're very cost conscious, and I'm glad that you mentioned that, because it really is an issue for a lot of people, and that's what a lot of people think and they perceive about any kind of healthier diet is, it's going to cost too much, and I've got to shop at Whole Foods or someplace that's going to cost me twice as much for everything. Really doesn't have to. And beginning, yeah, you're going to have to do a little searching, a little looking, and keep an eye out for sales and such, but you can really do. I was a poor college student and I did this, so it's very doable.
Yeah, and I was a single mother, and my kids ate only organic food, and they're now 38 and 35. So, You know, certainly if you're eating steamed vegetables and organic food, really is actually so much more cost-effective than eating junk food in the short run as well as the long run. And you're talking about the long run in terms of developing some of these degenerative illnesses with your specific focus on Alzheimer's disease. Now, I was interested in the fact that right in 2012, you discussed at the Clinical Trials of Alzheimer's Disease conference that actually it can help people who are already exhibiting symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to mention, you know, we are talking, diet is typically a longer-term thing, right? And that's sometimes discourages people because they say, I'm not going to see any benefit, and they don't know. And, you know, like good, delicious, unhealthy foods are usually rewarding, right? McDonald's tastes good. I know it right now. But the thing is, this isn't like years from now. They showed people with MCI, or we call it pre-Alzheimer's, mild cognitive impairment. Right, and even people with fully diagnosed Alzheimer's disease, they have regained some memory function by making changes in diet in weeks, in as little as 6 weeks, and I think I even saw a study in 1 month, right? So we're talking pretty immediate stuff. Again, these are dramatic effects for small changes. It's a low-cost, low-risk thing that it's kind of like, hey, why not?
That's exactly right. Because as you said, you wrote this with, let's say, not only diet, but good taste and low expense in mind. So that really gets rid of all the why not questions, doesn't it?
Right. That's what we wanted to do. And, you know, we understand, both my co-author and I do follow the diet. Richard Isaacson, my co-author, has a family history on both sides. So especially for him, he really is very, very, very strict about his diet. But we both, you know, we understand the normal things that people worry about. We like delicious food too, right? We don't want it to cost an arm and a leg every time we've got to do something. So, you know, we get it. We understand. And it's doable. That's really the message that we want people to know. It's really, really doable for anybody. It doesn't have to take a ton of time. It doesn't have to take a ton of money, and it doesn't have to take your favorite foods away from you.
No, and we're going to go into, you know, some of what those favorite foods might be that actually have been found more or less to be quite good for the brain. And why don't we just discuss one first before we go for our break, and that would be coffee, one of my favorite foods.
Yeah. A lot of people are happy to hear this one. It's true, there's been a lot of back and forth, right? Is coffee good? Is coffee bad? At least for Alzheimer's, and it actually look from recent studies, some other things too. Coffee is very beneficial. It has a neuroprotective effect, but here's the thing. It's caffeinated coffee, okay? And they don't really exactly know why, because there are a lot of antioxidants in the beans, right? But the thing is, decaf coffee does not have the same effect. Still good, just not the same effect. And caffeine itself has neuroprotective effects, but when they look at just the caffeine itself, it does not have the same effect as caffeinated coffee. So they've actually said there might be like substance X. They just have no idea why caffeinated coffee is so much more effective than either decaf or caffeine alone, but it is. So,
well, could it be, you know, when we look at the mechanism of action of some of those alkaloids, such as caffeine, and I'm not saying this is true, I'm just asking you, possibly, could it have an effect on the circulatory system where it actually increases circulation to the microvenules?
Sure.
Because I know it does, it changed the elasticity. I mean, that's what you feel, that waking up kind of rush from the caffeine.
Right. I was going to say, technically caffeine should do that also. So why is caffeinated coffee? Now, there may be a synergistic effect of you get the antioxidants with beans plus the caffeine,
mm-hmm.
sort of like a 1+1=3 type of thing. That may be going on. But, you know, the point, again, why exactly this stuff is working to us isn't, it's certainly important, but it's not as important as the fact that it is working, right? We can prove that it's working. And again, have a couple cups of coffee in the morning. We don't want to disturb sleep cycles, right? And some people are more sensitive to caffeine and so on and so forth. But so, you know, two to three cups of caffeine before lunch has a significant neuroprotective effect.
Well, thank you so much. You see that guest is telling us that the Alzheimer's diet not only can be delicious and nutritious, it can really support you in maintaining excellent brain health as we age. We're going to go to a break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we're going to go to a natural medicine chest, and when we come back, we will be continuing our discussion with Dr. Christopher Ohner, co-author of The Alzheimer's Diet. We'll be right back with more on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll explore the medicinal properties of the plants of the ephedra genera, focusing on the traditional Chinese ephedra, also known as mahuang.
Many species of the plant ephedra are used today in medicine throughout the world. The most medicinal of these are ephedra sinica, or Chinese mahuang, and ephedra nevadensis, also known as Mormon tea. Most of the research on ephedra has been performed on mahuang, whose stems and branches have been used as a traditional Chinese medicine for over 5,000 years in the treatment of asthma, hay fever, bronchitis, as well as the common cold.
Ephedra species are erect evergreen shrubs which grow in segmented bamboo-like joints reminiscent of straw ending in thin wisps. They typically are desert plants preferring arid conditions on dry, rocky, and sandy slopes. The Chinese ephedra, mahuang, has earned an impressive reputation as a source of the alkaloid chemical called ephedrine. In the West, scientists became interested in the medicinal usage of mahuang after they isolated ephedrine and pseudoephedrine in 1923. Today, synthetic derivatives have become widely used in prescription and over-the-counter medications. In 1993, over 40 million prescriptions in the U.S. contained these alkaloids.
Ephedra and its relatives are considered to act pharmacologically as sympathomimetic compounds. This means that they stimulate the sympathetic part of our central nervous system, responsible for the release of adrenaline, which leads to the fight or flight response. Ephedra also affects the cardiovascular system by increasing the blood pressure and causes a relaxation and dilation of the bronchial smooth muscles in asthmatics. Ephedra can shrink the swelling of the delicate mucous membranes which line the respiratory system, thus drying up watery discharges, unstuffing clogged nasal and sinus passages which accompany colds, sinus conditions, and allergies.
In both animal and human studies, mahuang has been shown to accelerate weight loss. It has been shown not only to suppress appetite, but to increase the metabolic activity of the adipose or fat tissue. Therefore, ephedra's weight-reducing effects are most significant in individuals who have a low metabolic rate or a sluggish thyroid gland.
Mahuang is a powerful herb which, when abused, can cause some unwanted side effects. Ephedra should not be taken by those with high blood pressure, nervousness or anxiety, insomnia, cardiac conditions, or pregnancy. Studies indicate that when used in conjunction with other Chinese herbs in a traditional formula, mahuang does not have any of these effects and has remarkable beneficial effects on human health.
We recommend consulting a healthcare practitioner knowledgeable in the use of botanical medicine before using mahuang. so you can be further educated about its totality of effects. And before using herbal preparations with Ma Huang, check to see if you are sensitive to its effects by starting with the minimal dose and working up to a therapeutic dose. Logically, since ephedra is a stimulant itself, it should be used prudently with other stimulants, beverages, or drugs with stimulant effects. Again, consult with your natural healthcare practitioner.
So, listeners, remember Ma Huang, the traditional Chinese ephedra, and make sure to include it in your natural medicine chest.
And welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse. And you can catch us at naturalnurse.com. Click on schedule and you'll be able to join us for many of our in-person lectures and tours. Click on books at naturalnurse.com to review some of the many books that we have written, including Arthritis, the Alternative Medicine Definitive Guide, which really mirrors a lot of the things we're talking about today with the author of The Alzheimer's Diet, who is our guest. And we are interviewing today Dr. Christopher Ochner. He is a leading researcher on nutrition and the brain at Mount Sinai School of Medicine and the New York Obesity Nutrition Research Center, along with Harvard-trained neurologist Richard Isaacson, who is an associate professor of clinical neurology who specializes in Alzheimer's disease at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Dr. Ochner co-authored The Alzheimer's Diet, a beautiful book that I highly recommend. It's a step-by-step nutritional approach for memory loss prevention and treatment. And you can find out more at www.alzheimersdiet.com. So welcome back, Dr. Ochner, Chris, for the second portion here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We're talking about your recommendations. We talked about coffee. That's good. We talked about berries. Hey, this sounds like a pretty good idea, this diet. Let's go into some of the no-nos, some of the things that if we eliminate from our diet, or let's say bring it down to once-a-week consumption rather than daily consumption, might be a good idea according to your research.
Sure. Probably the biggest one and the one we spend the most time talking about are carbohydrates. All right, now, all carbohydrates are not created equal, as my co-author would say, and it's very true. Overall, probably the best thing, if there were one recommendation that we were going to give people that either already have Alzheimer's, they are pre-Alzheimer's or MCI, or they're just concerned, right? They're looking for prevention. Probably the number one thing they can do is limit carbohydrates, not, you know, a low carbohydrate, like, you know, some of the other low carbohydrate diets out there where we want somebody to reach what's called ketosis. But, you know, just to moderate those carbohydrates and reduce the amount, because the typical American is taking in way too much carbohydrates. So we just want to bring it down somewhere between, you know, 75 and 100 grams of carbohydrates a day is ideal. We don't want people to go too crazy with counting and stuff if they really go on the diet. Maybe you do that for the first couple weeks, and then it should become sort of second nature. Then you kind of know, okay, that's got a lot of carbohydrates, and that's why those diets are actually pretty easy to follow, because people know, hey, pasta, that's carbohydrate. Bread, that's carbohydrate. So it's relatively straightforward.
Okay, well, what about vegetables, which also may have some carbohydrate? Like you said, they're not all created equal. Or let's say grains such as quinoa and millet versus white rice, or, you know, pasta, of course.
Good. All right, so you anticipated exactly where we were going. Yeah, exactly right. There are some good carbohydrates, and those, you know, if you're getting 100 grams a day of carbohydrate, that's great. We want to fill those with good carbohydrates. And exactly just like you said, there are certain grains, and particularly quinoa. Believe it or not, I just tried quinoa for the first time last week. It was delicious. It was so good. It wasn't, you know, some of these things, like there are recommendations. I mean, kale is wonderful for you. It's not my favorite thing in the world, but, you know, the flavoring varies on a lot of these things. Quinoa is actually delicious. So
it's delicious. It's crunchy. And another thing, for the fast-paced lifestyle that I'm sure you lead, Dr. Chris, and so many of our listeners do too, it cooks really quickly,
mm-hmm.
and it stays in the refrigerator for quite a few days, and then you can reheat it up, just quickly steam it. I've also used it, even for my kids, to make burgers the next few days, supposed burgers. I said, yeah, right, Mom? But it's phenomenally versatile and quite good for somebody who's a new user like yourself.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Especially if you put a little lime or lemon juice on it, it'll keep a little bit longer.
Well, it sounds like what you're talking about with carbs, which really is great, is to limit processed white flour kinds of things.
That's exactly it. So, you know, carbohydrates, I mean, for any diet, carbohydrates are a very important consideration, okay? And like we said, there's good and there's bad. The good carbs are usually located, and a lot of people have heard this before, it's very, very true. The good carbs are usually located on the perimeter of the supermarket, right? Particularly in the produce aisle, right? Those fresh fruits and vegetables, those are almost like a freebie. You can almost eat those as much as you want. The bad carbs are typically located in the middle, so you want to really spend much less time in the dried foods, the pasta and the rice aisle, okay, and more time in the produce aisle.
Yeah, so the thing is, it's about stocking up and actually being prepared, because so often if you just run out for the day and then you get hungry, people will grab the closest muffin or pizza or pasta. And that's where a lot of overeating of those things. And, of course, junk food. What about high fat and fried foods and fast foods and processed foods?
Great question. So there's really a lot of debate going on right now about particularly saturated fats. So, you know, the unsaturated fats we know are the good fats. I mean, same thing as carbohydrates, where there's good and bad. There's good fats and there's bad fats. And a lot of people wonder, are good fats really actually good for you? Are they just less bad? No, good fats are really actually good for you. They raise your HDL, or good cholesterol, and they help actually flush out the bad cholesterol from your body. So part of the reason, big part of the reason why we think the Mediterranean diet is so effective for heart disease and actually for Alzheimer's. That's probably got the most evidence in terms of style of diet. But saturated fats, particularly trans fats, we pretty much universally recognize as bad, okay? So there's not much discussion there. Limit your trans fats, okay? Now, the saturated fats, though, there's some suggestion as to whether or not, if they're natural, maybe they're actually not bad for you, maybe they're good for you, but it's when they're chemically produced and, you know, they essentially the saturation process, they take an unsaturated fat and make it saturated, that chemical process, when that's done artificially, maybe that's what makes it bad for you. The jury is out. Now, conventional or traditional thought and medicine and even evidence, even scientific evidence, says you want to limit your saturated fat, and that's what we go with. Okay, I've seen a lot of these new things come and go, and maybe something is good for you, and you know, we used to eat high carb and then it's low carb and high protein and low protein, but it keeps going back and forth. So the real mainstay, okay, what we've really thought, I want to say thought, well, we've had a lot of evidence for in the past, you know, 30 years, that saturated fat really should be limited. So we recommend 7%. Again, we don't need people to be measuring and be precise right down to the half a percent, so on and so forth, but basically the message is limit your saturated fat.
Right, and it is a confusing message, which is good for you because you're not going to run out of things to investigate in your lifetime, because there's always new information coming in. And like you said, almost every statement you said cannot be, it has caveats. For instance, with saturated fat, I would say if that's a simple concept to avoid or limit them, that's fine. But when we look at something like raw, organic, unhydrogenated coconut oil, which is a saturated fat, and I am not sure on specific research that has been done with it and Alzheimer's disease, but it definitely seems to have a brain protective effect.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that is a very hot topic, and we get this question all the time. I'm also glad you mentioned about the research, and that's really what's lacking right now. So at this point, and you also really, really got it exactly right, which was the pure and unhydrogenated, that's really, really important, because if people are not using that, right, then they are getting just a boatload of trans fats and really bad stuff. So we want to say if people are going to, you know, if people are going to try that anyhow, okay, we don't really have a lot of supportive evidence yet. It doesn't mean it doesn't work. It just means it hasn't been fully tested yet. Okay, if people want to try it, they just need to be really careful about making sure they go with the natural and the unhydrogenated. So that's pretty much it. We don't recommend it yet just because the evidence is not there, and that's really what we decided to stick to, whereas what do we have evidence on? And then we, with that, we weigh, you know, is there any risk involved? What's the sort of cost potential benefit ratio of these, and the things that have some evidence and are low risk we recommend, and other things such as coconut oil we say I would wait and see.
Well, one thing that's in your book that maybe many people have not heard of, but which I always do, and I don't do it necessarily to ward off Alzheimer's, which I have to say there's got to be a genetic component as well, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, we go to that, because I have to say nobody in my huge family has ever had anything like that. They all maintain complete patency in terms of mental capacity until really over 100 has been
wow. The
ongoing, you know, pattern in my parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. Yeah, so, you know, I picked the right path to come through in terms of
that. The right family.
So there must be something about that, too. Is there a genetic link?
Oh, sure, absolutely. So it won't go too far into, you know, the actual genes, the APOE, and the different markers that can carry. But there are some people that actually can have a genetic protective.
Now, is it for genetic, do you think, or is it also familial eating pattern, perhaps?
Well, a little bit of both. Two different things. So everything we say, everything is sort of a consequence of genes and environment, right? It's literally everything is subsumed under genes and environment. And so genes are your genes. That's your biology. That's what you're born with. It's a mom and dad give you, you know, one copy of one copy of the other. Environment is everything else, including your parental modeling, including what you were raised on, including, you know, social, psychological, ideological, and biological, you know, any other factors, not biological, sorry, but any other factors other than your genes and biology counts towards environment. So if you have a genetic, if it runs in your family, okay, particularly mom, all right, the genetic load.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. I love to learn more. So you're saying there seems to be a stronger genetic link to the mother.
Yes, absolutely. Pretty much with everything genetic, the load is a little bit higher for mom.
Except what about male pattern baldness? I don't know. You haven't researched that.
I don't know. I keep hearing about that, and they say it's mom's dad, actually.
Right, that's what I've heard.
So,
right.
But anyhow. No, so you're going to look at mom and dad, and if mom and or dad have it, okay, people have what's called a predisposition or a greater chance, a greater likelihood of developing Alzheimer's. It doesn't mean they will, doesn't mean they won't. It just is an increased chance, okay? So, you know, for, like I mentioned, my co-author has a genetic risk on both sides of his family and his parents. And so he's got a higher risk, and so he chooses to really, really, really practice prevention. He's 35 years old and is really avid about his prevention right now. So we really recommend that. It's, again, it's not sort of necessary or sufficient, meaning that somebody without genetic risk, without any sort of predisposition, can still develop Alzheimer's, okay? And people with that predisposition can never develop Alzheimer's, okay? Alzheimer's is, like we said before, in the later stages of life, it becomes, you know, over 50% of people 85 and older develop symptoms of Alzheimer's. So, you know, it's something, it's a reality, it's something we want to be conscious of. We don't have to live fearfully, but we think we should be proactive in trying to push that off, because now we know we can push that off.
Now, one thing that I read in your book, which really I haven't seen discussed too much, is the fact that I have always felt that the best time to have the big meal of the day, and this is what I do every day, I have my big meal of the day at 3 p.m.,
mm-hmm.
and then in the evening I have a little snack like a cup of tea and a rice cake. I don't eat a dinner at 7 or 8 or 9 p.m. before I'm going to bed at 11.
Mm-hmm. It's very European of you.
But it's just what I feel. I sleep better. I just personally developed that pattern, not having read it in your book as a recommendation or anything, just because I sleep better when I'm not sleeping on this big empty stomach. I mean, big full stomach. But what has your research uncovered in terms of that?
Sure. So there's sort of a couple of key issues here, and the jury, to some extent, is still out. You know, in relation to Alzheimer's and in relation to, you know, other diseases, particularly obesity, weight gain, things like that, that people are, almost all of us, are at least conscious of. So, you know, eating the big meal during the day versus at night, there's not direct evidence showing that that has a large effect on average, because different people react differently to that. Different times of day and different patterns work better or worse for different people. So we typically say, you know, find a pattern that works for you, as long as it's not, you know, binging and purging or starving yourself or something unhealthy, but find a pattern where you can get good nutrition that works for you and stick with it. So that's probably the number one thing that we would say. Now, for Alzheimer's, there is some evidence, interesting, we talk about a 12 to 14 hour fast. Okay, we don't want people starving themselves, but if people eat, you know, their last meal, whether it be large or medium or whatever it is, their last meal at, you know, let's say 6, 7 p.m., whatever it is, and then don't eat again until, you know, 7, 8 a.m. the next morning, maybe they'll have a small breakfast, whatever, you know, overnight, over the course of those 12, 13, 14 hours, the body will start producing what's called ketone bodies, okay? And this is what happens. This is the whole concept behind a low-carbohydrate diet, actually. It does help in weight loss, but for the brain, it's particularly helpful because, okay, ketone bodies are the only other fuel source besides glucose that your brain can use. The only thing we can use to power the brain, okay? And we think it seems to be basically a cleaner burning fuel, all right? What happens with these high carbohydrate diets and overeating and things like that, we actually get almost diabetes of the brain. A lot of people have suggested that maybe Alzheimer's is diabetes type 3, because what's happening is you're getting, you know, just like you would get insulin resistance in your body and maybe develop into diabetes type 2, you actually get insulin resistance in the brain, and particularly in the area of the brain that's responsible for essentially doling out new memories, sending them to the areas of the brain in which they're going to be stored, which is a lot of times why you'll see preservation of old established memories in Alzheimer's patients, but they can't retain new stuff. They're actually getting essentially diabetes in the hippocampus of the brain. So, you know, we want people to sort of be conscious of that and be aware of, you know, if they're going to eat carbohydrates or if they're going to look at what's going to go into that, be conscious of, it's almost a diabetic diet for the brain. And so we want to be able to avoid that. But ketone bodies are going to help avoid that insulin resistance that builds up, because the brain essentially stops regulating its glucose metabolism, all right? And ketone bodies also don't produce as much byproduct. They call them free radicals. It's sort of like a car engine, right? It's burning, and you need a muffler to sort of take some of the toxins out of the exhaust that goes into the air. It's the same thing with your brain. When your brain's burning glucose, it releases free radicals that actually do damage the brain. And so ketone bodies will help, and a lot of these other techniques that we talk about will help neutralize those free radicals, all right, so you don't get as much neural damage.
Very interesting discussion, and I'm sure that is very new information to many of our listeners. So thank you so much, Dr. Ochno, Dr. Chris. We're going to take our next break right here, and you'll find out about all the exciting shows that you can listen to right here on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. We'll be right back with more on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Welcome back once again for more The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. And we're so happy to have you with us today. And we're very happy to have our guest, Dr. Christopher Ochner, who is a leading researcher on nutrition and the brain at Mount Sinai School of Medicine and the New York Obesity Nutrition Research Center. And we're talking about his book, The Alzheimer's Diet. You can find out more on thealzheimersdiet.com. What is on that website, Dr. Ochner? I haven't had a chance to go to it as yet.
Sure. You can go to alzheimersdiet.com or thealzheimersdiet.com, either one. It's a page that describes a little bit about the book, and we're just in the midst of updating it right now, so we apologize for any construction messages. But now there's some quotes. We've gotten some really nice reviews, and the book has done well, so of course we put a couple of those up there, and a couple of clips. We've done some media. My co-author was just on Good Day LA, just did a spot on the book for New York One, so we have a couple of clips up there that people can look at, and then brief biographies about Dr. Isaacson and myself, and then just a little summary about the book and what people can expect. And the last thing is, we also, I almost forgot, but we are in the midst, we're reaching the end of developing a nutrition tracking system that is a companion to the book, where when people go on the 9-week diet plan contained within the book, we ask them to track certain things that are going to make it easier for them to carry this into the future. So it's a diet that sustains. And so for the first several weeks, we have them track certain things and write some things down, and that they can do all online.
Well, the book has so many great and easy tips, and you have a wonderful whole chapter on dietary supplements, and you do focus on the fact that these should be considered supplements. That doesn't mean instead of healthy eating, but in addition to healthy eating, to just fill in the gaps.
Absolutely, absolutely. We always say, and most physicians will say the same thing, ideally, you most definitely want to get your minerals and vitamins from food. Okay, but given that some people may be on a weight loss diet where they're, you know, not consuming enough calories to get all those, or the fact of the matter is they just couldn't consume enough different foods on a given day, whatever the reason be, there are certainly reasons why we may not always be able to consume a fully balanced diet and get all of our nutrients. In that case, yes, a supplement's better than nothing, but getting those vitamins and minerals from real food is better than supplements.
But you do have a list of some supplements that have very good evidence, since everything you do is evidence-based, in terms of perhaps using as supplements that do have known brain health effects.
Sure. So a few are, people can supplement the omega-3 fatty acids, particularly DHA and EPA. Okay, those are the ones shown to have the real neuroprotective effects. And again, we would rather they come from foods like fish, like mackerel, herring, lake trout, albacore tuna, things like that. But you can get a supplement. Okay, just make sure, typically with supplement, not always, but typically it's a you get what you pay for type of thing. So we just want people to be a little bit weary, do a little bit of research online and find out which ones are the good ones. And just make sure you're getting a high concentration, again, of DHA and EPA. All right, and then maybe some vitamins. I mean, a multivitamin is usually a good idea, particularly if people aren't consuming enough calories, getting enough vitamins from their foods. But specifically things like folic acid, B1, B6, B12, and vitamin D also have some really good evidence. And we would recommend the same thing. Buy essentially the best one you can afford.
Boy, your recipes look fabulous. How about the balsamic fig sauce? Who made that one up? That's great.
Yeah, well, believe it or not, those recipes actually took quite a bit of research. So we went in and found some low glycemic index is another thing we spend a decent amount of time talking about. And that has to do with carbohydrates and what we were talking before. So low glycemic are those good carbohydrates. And then we adjusted those recipes. So it's sort of two rounds of health. They were healthy recipes to begin with, and then we adjusted them specifically for brain health. And we wanted to make sure, again, we want people to think this, their brain healthy diet is delicious, because if there's one thing we have learned, right, especially studying nutrition and dieting for the last 20 years, right, is that if people don't enjoy their diets, they're not going to stick to it.
Well, see, your entire eating regime in your book, The Alzheimer's Diet, you could do it for Alzheimer's, fine. That's great if that's your motivation, no problem. But the alternate effects of using this kind of diet and menu option plan would be reestablishment of a healthy weight, even if that's not your focus, if you are overweight. If you're not overweight, you're not going to lose weight because it's super excellent and healthy. So if someone does have a few extra pounds, they may find they just kind of melt away without trying. But of course, this diet will also get rid of all kinds of aches and pains and other inflammatory process problems.
Absolutely, absolutely right. It's a double benefit type of thing, maybe even triple benefit. But what we say is good for the brain is good for the heart and vice versa, and it's really true. So, you know, a lot of the things we recommend, you will see the same sort of themes throughout the Mediterranean diet and other styles of diet that have been shown to have really profound effects on coronary heart disease, on blood pressure, on a lot of these things, and obesity. And, right, we all want to look good at the same time that we want to feel good, and that's important too. So absolutely 100% right. We get reports, and we love hearing that, the people, I've lost 5 pounds already, I've lost 10 pounds, I wasn't even trying. That's great. We, you know, and for the key, though, is that people say it's something that they can stick to. They don't feel like they're on a diet, they're in dietary jail, we call it. We want to avoid that, because then, you know, you're going to do it for a couple months and then forget it. And that's the way most diets go. This should be, we want people to relearn a new and healthier relationship with food for the rest of their lives.
Well, that is great recommendation, and I want to thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Christopher Ochner, for working so hard on making this book something that is so user-friendly, especially for people as we age. I mean, I really appreciate books with large writing, I'll tell you. That makes it me want to read it, and I actually did take your book on one of my many airplane rides, which I do almost weekly to lecture around the country and around the world. And it was very easy reading, but very scientifically sound. And what is the best way for people to find you and the book?
Sure. It really is at www.thealzheimersdiet.com. It's available on Amazon. You can just search for The Alzheimer's Diet. And that's really the best way. We have a lot of links to a lot of different things. We have great blogs. We have other resources for people to get a hold of right there. And so people will be able to find all of that right there.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you, listeners, for joining us once again right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And until next time, we hope that you come back to PRN.FM often and listen to the archives as well as the shows that might be airing live at that particular moment. And you can always find us at naturalnurse.com on the web, or you can join our discussions on Facebook at Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we'd love to see you in person. Come to our herb walks, Chinatown walks, trips overseas, and also we have classes online for those of you who'd like to learn more about how to use integrative and natural health techniques in your life. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.